Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. President Obama recently acknowledged that U.S. drones have killed innocent civilians. At the same time, he continues to defend the drone program as a necessary part of the United States military operations. Human rights organizations and several independent investigations have challenged the assertions that civilian casualties are rare. For example, an investigation by the London-based Bureau of Investigative Journalism shows that since President Obama took office in 2009, 462 drone strikes in Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia have killed 289 civilians. According to the UN Assistance Mission in Afghanistan, between January 2009 and the end of last year, over 24,000 bombs killed 1,214 civilians, or one civilian per 21 bombs dropped. So what do we need to know about the United States drone program, and what happens when drone operators decide to speak out? The new documentary, National Bird, gives chilling testimonies by three courageous whistleblowers who decide to break their silence and speak out against the drone program. The film also gives a voice to innocent survivors of the U.S. drone attacks in Afghanistan. National Bird's director, Sonia Kennebec, is the first Western filmmaker to talk to survivors of the tragic 2010 drone strike that killed 23 civilians in Afghanistan. Some of these Afghans lost their limbs and their loved ones, and they told Sonia Kennebec that they have one wish, and that is for the United States to stop its deadly attacks on innocent people. Sonia Kennebec is an award-winning independent documentary filmmaker and investigative journalist whose films focus on international politics and human rights issues. National Bird is her first feature-length documentary. It'll be screened at the San Francisco International Film Festival on May 1st at 8 o'clock at the Victoria Theater in San Francisco, May 2nd at 12:30 at the Alamo Draft House in San Francisco, May 3rd at 4 o'clock at the Berkeley Art Museum and Pacific Film Archive in Berkeley, and Sonia Kennebec will be at all of the screenings. The film will also be in theaters nationwide in the fall, and Sonia Kennebec joins us on the line from Washington, D.C. Hi, Sonia. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Hello. Thank you for having me here.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Protop Chatterjee, managing editor of CorpWatch, a nonprofit independent investigative journalism and advocacy organization focusing on multinational corporate accountability and transparency. Protop Chatterjee is the author of Halliburton's Army, How a Well-Connected Texas Oil Company Revolutionized the Way America Makes War. And Protop joins us from his office in Berkeley. Hi, Protop. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rose.
It's great to have you. We're also joined by Lisa Ling. Lisa is a whistleblower and former drone system technical sergeant. Lisa was in the Air Force. She served in the military from 1991 to 2012. She served in the drone program for 2 years. And Lisa Ling joins me in studio. Hi, Lisa. Thank you for coming in.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. So, Sonia, congratulations on this documentary. For the past several years, we have done many shows about drones, about whistleblowers, veterans suffering from PTSD. Some of the whistleblowers in your film suffer from PTSD. But it is the first time, other than a few short news segments, that we actually hear from drone operators and victims telling their own stories. First off, what drew you to this topic?
Well, my background is in investigative journalism. And when I first started my research 3 years ago, I wanted to make a film either about the drone program or about veteran suicides. You just mentioned, you know, the issue and the veterans and PTSD, and it's currently a statistic that 22 veterans a day commit suicide. So I was, you know, really shocked by this statistic. And when I first looked for people who worked within the drone program, and I really wanted to make a film about the people, I didn't want to talk to journalists, experts, pundits, but I actually wanted to speak to people directly impacted by drone warfare in the U.S., who worked in the drone program, but also in the target countries. My first protagonist who I found was Heather. And in our first conversation, she told me that she has lost three of her fellow airmen to suicide, and these kind of two issues that I was interested in intersected, and I just wanted to know more about it.
And Heather was one of the first analysts to publicly criticize the drone program, and she's also one of the first drone operators to be diagnosed and treated for PTSD.
Yes, that's correct, yeah.
Can you tell us how you found Heather? I mean, what really struck me about her is that she's so young, and she was given so much responsibility at a time when she's so young and so inexperienced.
Yes, you're absolutely right, and that surprised me as well. And I think Lisa can elaborate more on that. But it is a fact that the young airmen, the people like Heather, who analyze the video of the drones, the live video coming from the drones, have to make the call. What I'm seeing on this, often, blurry video, is this a terrorist or is it a civilian? So they have a lot of responsibility because, their decision, their call, their judgment, might lead to the death of people. And so I, when I first, started the research, I talked to veterans and activists that I know, groups, the community that I've reported on before, and I came across a photograph of a young woman, and she was holding up a sheet of paper that said something along the lines of, not everything you hear about the drone program is true. I know what I'm talking about. And so this young woman covered up most of her face. All you could see were her eyes. And I was curious. I was wondering if this person, this young woman, is the same person who knows about the drone program, who knows the truth. And so I went on a little bit of a detective, like a hunt, and I was cross-referencing people because the photo was posted by someone else. And I eventually came across Heather's profile photo on Facebook, and I recognized the eyes. And I contacted her, and I said, are you this person on the photograph? Do you actually know about the drone program? And she said yes, and that's how we met the first time. Mm.
Lisa, what would you say about that? Those of us who don't know much about the program but then see the people behind it are shocked that they're so young and so inexperienced. How common is this?
It's pretty common. I mean, usually about ages 18 to 24, they go through their basic training, and then they get about, some more time training to be able to recognize things in the video. And then they show up, at a drone site and get to work.
And so they're looking at, is this an adult? Is this a child? What age could this child be? Maybe 6, maybe 12? And then they make those decisions?
Well, it's a distributed system. And so essentially all of the decisions are distributed. But some of the disturbing things are that there's no feedback given. So you really don't know. Did I help for this person or this situation to end in loss of life or loss of limbs? And to me, for people that young, it's pretty tragic.
How much training did you get?
Well, for me, it's an interesting question. I got waivered into my technical training.
What does that mean?
That means that I already knew how to use, computer-type equipment before I transferred from the Army side to the Air side. So I got some training, some different classes, but I never went through the type of training that many people do.
Pratap Chatterjee, you have spent many years working on investigating the drone program. Back in November, four former U.S. Air Force service members said that President Obama's drone war is a recruitment tool for ISIS. Now, at the time, this didn't get that much attention. And now we have this new documentary, National Bird, which it looks like is starting to get a lot more attention. So can you talk a little bit more about these drone whistleblowers? And why is it that it didn't get much attention in November, but now I understand that Nightline is planning to do a piece on National Bird?
Well, I think it takes time for people to focus on an issue, and I think it's also the good work of the support organizations that have been helping out the whistleblowers. So In particular, I want to mention Jocelyn Raddick, who is the lawyer for a lot of these whistleblowers. The four airmen that were mentioned in November, Michael Haas, Stephen Lewis, Sean Westmoreland, and Brandon Bryant, they share a common lawyer. And Jocelyn has been doing amazing work in terms of trying to get this issue out into the public and to support the whistleblowers. So that's one of the reasons why you're seeing more attention now to these issues. But it's also, you know, the media isn't necessarily going to believe a group of young people who say, you know, well, we saw bad things. When a general comes to them, you know, the New York Times pays attention. And it's typically a young person who hasn't finished college, and a lot of them, as you said before, are not necessarily going to get media attention unless they're supported, and they are not necessarily media savvy. You know, they're not out there trying to pick up on things and push their agenda. So it takes the support of groups like Justin's group, which is called Whisper, and I forget what it stands for, but it's a whistleblower and security, national security program, I think. I'll look it up. Maybe Lisa remembers the actual name. But that's one of the reasons why I think they've been able to bring this attention, this issue to attention. And I also want to say, actually, the work that Sony has done in terms of putting this film together is, you know, it's 3 years of hard work. You know, she went to Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. She spent months with each of these whistleblowers. And so I think people are paying attention because it's not just a one-off. I did an interview for half an hour over the phone with some person who says that, I mean, it's clear when you see the film, the detail and the issues that these whistleblowers are facing, and in particular, and I'm sure you'll get into this, the PTSD, the post-traumatic stress disorder that's affecting them. And I think that's something when people see it physically on the screen, people sit up and take notice. And so really, honestly, congratulations to Sonia and thank you to all the whistleblowers that have done such have opened up to her to tell us really what the impact of the drone war is at home, because we know to a certain extent what's happening overseas. It is having a very debilitating impact on literally thousands of drone pilots, imagery analysts, and the whole support infrastructure. There are thousands of people here stateside that are working on that, and they're being affected by what they see because they know it's wrong, and they have nightmares about it. They have to go to counseling. Some of them turn to alcohol and drugs. Some of them commit suicide, mm-hmm. and that comes across very clearly in Sonia's film. So I think that's what is making people, the media sit up.
Right. You mentioned Jocelyn Raddick, who is also representing Daniel in the film, and she says that you can't even imagine the economic price, but also the emotional price. You can't talk to your friends and your family about what's going on. The costs are really indescribable. So, Lisa, at what point did you decide to speak out and share your story?
Well, I decided to speak out. Well, I wasn't sure what I was going to do. I knew what I had participated in was wrong, and I had taken a trip to Afghanistan before. And I just, when you see these people in all of their dimensions, you know, it's a lot different than the two-dimensional view you get with the feeds. And they're wonderful, amazing people there. And in the drone program, everything, all the words are sanitized. You know, the words like target. And what happens is we forget that what we're talking about are people, families, children. And they all, you know, have a right to live.
Can you talk about your experience in going to Afghanistan, why you decided to take that trip?
Because I wanted to see the people of Afghanistan in person, because you really don't get the real information about what's going on sitting stateside. I really felt that I wanted to see people in person. I wanted to see the children. I wanted to see what was really going on and what people are really like there. And I wanted to kind of embrace the humanity. It's not a technical thing, and yet we've relegated the drone war to technical terms. And that leaves humanity completely out of the picture. So the goal for me is to, you know, let people know that not everybody from a foreign country who may practice religion differently or who may wear different clothing is a terrorist. And we have to get out of that mindset and more into these are human beings, very much like we are human beings.
Were you with Sonia when she was filming the families who were bombed in Afghanistan on February 21st, 2010?
I don't know that I was with her specifically on that day. There was a day when I was there. And
can you describe what that experience was like? Because these families describe what happened to them. They also send a message to Americans. What was that experience like meeting them?
Well, I only met them for a short time, and the fact that they are very forgiving. I mean, all they're asking us is to please stop. Just please stop. And they're saying, you know, for all of their friends and family who've died or who've been injured, or just please stop. And the thing about drones, I mean, and people keep comparing them to regular airplanes and to regular ordnance that gets dropped. It's not the same thing. When a plane comes, I mean, you know, through all World War II, everything, right? Everybody knows that when a plane is coming and the bomb alarm goes off, you run into a bomb shelter and you try to protect yourself. Well, with a drone, there isn't that chance or that opportunity because they can loiter for extended periods of time and no one knows, are they armed, you know, is my grandmother going to get hit? I mean, it's terror.
Sonia, what was that like for you? Because as Lisa was describing that, I remember the scene where the Afghan family was sitting on the ground, and I think it was a helicopter that was hovering above, and you could just see the fear in their faces, not knowing what it is or what might happen.
Yeah, it's. I mean, these helicopters were flying above our heads all the time. So, I thought it was very important to show what fear it creates, because they, all these families, but you know, all of Afghans have been living in a war zone for so long, and it's really traumatizing. But in particular, of course, if you've had, you know, if you've been in an attack, if you've lost your loved ones, if you've lost your limbs, it just creates, you know, so much fear. And one of the sons of the woman that you actually see in this footage with her other kids when the helicopter's flying overhead and the boy is kind of holding his ears and everyone's like shaking and afraid. One of her older sons who was also on the attack, he can't even leave the house anymore. He's so scared that he's afraid to step outside and so traumatized. So the impact of a drone strike and a drone strike surveying and hovering over the people goes so far beyond the actual strike. So, you know, it alters their lives forever. And even people who are not, you know, directly affected by a strike know about it, and kids know about it. They are very educated about drones in Afghanistan. And so they are just afraid. They are afraid of the sky, essentially.
Pratap, on April 1st, President Obama defended the U.S. drone policy. At the same time, he admitted that the U.S. had at times killed innocent civilians. The government has consistently downplayed civilian deaths, but because of investigations and human rights organizations' investigations, we know that drone attacks have killed innocent civilians. And human rights groups, the ACLU, for example, have pressured the Obama administration to bring greater accountability to the use and the scope of these drone strikes. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, there are some hard numbers out there that have been gathered by a variety of different organizations. For example, the New America Foundation estimates that 10% of drone strikes kill innocent people. The Bureau of Investigative Journalism estimates that 20%. And the way they determine these numbers, which is that they go over newspaper reports of each strike and they determine the number of women and children and use that as a rough way to figure out who clearly could not have been a terrorist. And in fact, the numbers could be much higher. We don't know. I mean, just because somebody's a man doesn't necessarily mean they're a terrorist. I know men aren't that great, but still. it's clear that the numbers are much higher than the stray casualty that that President Obama indicates. And I would even argue, go so far as to argue, if you have not given the person you're targeting the opportunity to have witnesses and a jury and that sort of thing, you don't know if they're guilty. I mean, a great example of an innocent person in the United States who was let free after 43 years is Albert Woodfox of the Angola 3. How do we know, how does President Obama know, how does anybody know whether or not the people they're looking at through these very blurry, Sonia says, these video images are very blurry. So we don't know if they're guilty. We have no real way of telling. There's a moment in the film where Lisa says, you know, does the government go down and pick up a driver's license and figure out whether or not they killed the right person? The U.S. government doesn't do after post-strike investigations. So in reality, what President Obama is saying is completely, you know, is downplaying by a magnitude of at least a factor of 10, probably much greater, the impact of these drones. There is no way that it's just a couple of people. You can't kill. There aren't 3,000 people in Waziristan who are attempting to bring down the Twin Towers. This is a very remote part of Yemen, and so I think they're just lying to cover up what they've done. And I think what we really need is an actual counting of who they claim they've killed and how they've determined these people are terrorists. And I think if that kind of list was published, their rationale would completely fall apart.
Lisa, what are your thoughts on that?
My thoughts are that it's interesting to me that when we talk about letting some of the refugee population into our country, everybody says, no, we can't figure out who's who. But when it comes to drone strikes, somehow we can. I don't understand the disconnect there.
Protop, you've written a lot about innocent people who've been hit by drones. What about accountability? How do you answer that question?
Well, that's a good question. I want to actually give you the example. Since I've been to Pakistan, I've met with victims of drone strikes. And in fact, unusually, in 2011, I attended a jirga put on by a group called Reprieve in Britain, in which about 50 people whose relatives had been killed, and in fact two people in that jirga actually been struck by drones themselves. And I met with them, and among them was a young man by the name of Tariq Aziz. He was really just a boy. He was 16. I filmed the whole gathering. I filmed every one of them. I met them. And after I left, 3 days later, the CIA killed Tariq Aziz, and they claimed he was a terrorist. Now, I have to ask this question. If I, as a foreigner, could go and meet Tariq Aziz at a public meeting in Islamabad, how is it possible that the Pakistani government and the U.S. government was not able to detain him and ask him questions? Now, in my conversations, I've called the CIA. They won't call me back. They won't explain what happened. The Washington Post has called the CIA, and they say, well, we know he was a terrorist. My question is, if it was possible for me to meet this young man, this boy, how is it possible that they could not do that and they cannot publish the rationale for killing him? They have remained completely silent except telling the Washington Post in secret, we know he was a terrorist. So there is no system of accountability. There is no system of transparency. I'm waiting to hear what Obama will publish, to see what he publishes. But I would suspect that there's going to be some very, very minimal numbers and that sort of thing. Let me give you another example. Recently, the Obama administration admitted last year to have killed two Westerners, Warren Weinstein and Giovanni Laporto, by mistake in a drone strike. And they've said that they would release the data on that. President Obama actually went before the nation and personally apologized. And he said, I will ensure that the details of this drone strike are published. That was, I think, 14 months ago. We have seen nothing. So there's even for strikes that they've apologized for, there's neither transparency nor accountability. So I think it behooves, I'm really glad that groups like Reprieve and Whisper out there, that are pushing the government and the ACLU and Amnesty and Human Rights Watch, which have published reports on this, because without them, we wouldn't really see the kind of detail we're getting, because these groups have gone into the field, done reports, and brought back evidence that proved that innocent women and children have been killed.
Well, and Sonia Kennebec, the filmmaker of National Bird, says she wanted to bring transparency to the drone program, and we'll talk more about that after a break. Pratap Chatterjee is managing editor of CorpWatch, a nonprofit investigative advocacy organization focusing on multinational accountability and transparency. He's done extensive work on the drone program. Sonia Kennebec's new film is National Bird. It will be at the San Francisco International Film Festival. I'll give you more information about it after the break. And we're also joined by Lisa Ling, a whistleblower and former drone system technical sergeant. If you have any questions about the drone program, we'd love to hear from you. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a program that relies on engaged listeners. If you'd like to join today's conversation, the toll-free number is 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255, or you can send your question or comment via email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock from the BBC, it will be World Have Your Say. And following that at noon, John Perry and Ken Taylor and Philosophy Talk.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will discuss the City College of San Francisco's faculty strike. After a year of failed negotiations, the union that represents City College faculty has called for a one-day strike tomorrow. It's the first strike in the union's three-decade history. So what are the issues at stake and how can they be resolved? That's tomorrow. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the new documentary National Bird, which gives chilling testimonies by three courageous whistleblowers who break their silence and speak out against the U.S. secret drone program. Sonia Kennebec made this film. It'll be screened at the San Francisco International Film Festival May 1st at 8 o'clock at the Victoria Theater in San Francisco, May 2nd at 12:30 at the Alamo Draft House in San Francisco, May 3rd at 4 o'clock at the Berkeley Art Museum in Berkeley, and Sonia will be at all of the screenings. We're also joined by Lisa Ling, a whistleblower and former drone system technical sergeant. She served in the military from 1991 to 2012, served in the drone program for 2 years. And Pratap Chatterjee is managing editor of CorpWatch. He's author of Halliburton's Army, and he's done extensive work on the drone program. Sonia, before we get to talking more about the personal stories of these drone operators, talk a little bit about your overall goal with this film. I mean, you really wanted to bring some transparency to this drone program.
Yes. Just before that, I would like to add that Lisa Ling, who is in the studio with you right now, she's actually also going to do the Q&As with me together at all of the screenings at the San Francisco International Film Festival. And I believe at least at some of the screenings, her friend, our friend Asma, who is Afghan, who was our guide and our translator and a really important person for our Afghan protagonist to play a big role in the film. She will most likely join our Q&As as well. So if people are interested in talking to them, it's, you know, this is a good opportunity. And so, you know, the overall goal when I started the film was that I really wanted to give voice to the people who are directly impacted by drone warfare, and as we have discussed before, you know, bring transparency into the program, because There are a lot of flaws within this program that have not been really publicly discussed, and the official narrative makes it seem, you know, that the program is very accurate and surgical strikes, and when you watch you know, Air Force commercials or you know, even movies, you know, that cover the drone program, you often see images that are very clear, like full HD images of the people that are being watched and being targeted. And the protagonists that I've talked to, the drone whistleblowers that I've talked to, they all say that the images, their reality is quite different. The images are often blurry. You know, there is sometimes a delay between the live video until it reaches the bases in the U.S. You know, you have interferences, and they are just sometimes, you know, out of focus. And sometimes the people that they are watching are just black blobs, and you know, you can't really decipher from an image like that if a person is, you know, a woman or a man or even a child. So I think this really needs to be discussed, and the public needs to know about it to make a decision eventually. Is this the type of warfare that we want? So that's the type of information I wanted to provide with this film.
The other thing that struck me, Lisa, is when the drone operators were talking about the children, and again, they're sort of black blobs on the screen, and one operator would say, he looks like he's 8, and another operator would say, well, he might be 14, which means he's old enough to be a potential terrorist. So can you talk about that, how the operators talk about children and these ages?
There's a couple of things that I want to say. One is that no matter how clear the video is, you're still going to only see two dimensions. You're still, I mean, imagine standing on a roof and looking down on New York. Do you think you could tell who's a criminal, who's not, or even if somebody is carrying a pistol? I mean, and that's on a roof looking over New York. So I don't see how, you know, the quality of the feed would be a solution here. And the other thing is, I mean, we're taught the words are sanitary, right? So, I mean, is it a toddler? Is it a teenager? That wasn't my particular training. I was more the technical aspects. But when you hear people talk, there's something that happens in the military where you have to dehumanize your enemy. That's part of war and conflict and all of that. And the thing about it is that it's one thing to be in the fight where somebody's aiming at you or aiming at the person next to you, and you can justify that in your mind as defending yourself or defending your battle buddy or some sort of defense. But it's hard to wrap your mind around being on the other side of the globe and then having what you've done result in the deaths of one or many, and you don't really know because the feedback isn't really brought back to you. It's just in my view the wrong way to do war.
So as a drone systems technical sergeant, what did you do exactly?
I basically worked on the equipment. And so I, you know, ran different tests and that kind of thing. It was, for me, it was, the majority of it was technical. But the things that got to me, I mean, I will say it was my worst, basically, deployment ever. And, you know, I've been in the military since 91, so that's saying something. But basically, what I saw was a lot of young people, a lot of drunk drivings, a lot of, you know, a lot of emails that said, hey, don't try this spice or this or that thing. And as an older individual being and watching this happen to basically what amounts to America's young people, what'll happen to them afterwards? I mean, they're leaving in droves. They're hiring contractors to replace people. And the other thing that people don't understand is, yeah, they work in the United States, but they're on a war footing. which means that they're working extra long hours, getting very little sleep, as if they've deployed and had the amount of time on an airplane to decompress and the amount of time on an airplane coming back to decompress. No, it's very schizophrenic. You go on this side of the threshold and you're at war and the operational tempo is really quick and you're working extremely long hours and you're highly stressed, and then you walk to the other side and you listen to somebody talking about missing a TV show. It's a very schizophrenic way to live, and it's bound to give America's young people mental problems.
Can you talk more about this? Because I remember the first time we sort of met a drone operator was 60 Minutes did a piece about the Air Force Base in Las Vegas, I believe. And a lot of people at that time said, well, how can these people experience PTSD when they're pushing buttons and they're not actually seeing what's happening on the ground? But Heather, who's in the documentary, says that she saw a lot of people dying after the explosion. You actually see the limbs. You can actually see what happened. And she said it caused a lot of anxiety and sleep disorder. She was on suicide watch for some time. Again, she's one of the first analysts to publicly criticize the program and one of the first drone operators to be diagnosed and treated for PTSD. So can you elaborate on that side of it so we really understand what these drone operators do and how it affects them?
So PTSD, post-traumatic stress. So stress after a trauma is what the words actually mean. I'm not a doctor. I'm not anybody. But what I know is that the environment is just incredibly stressful. And there's also the new concept that has been coming out for a while of moral injury. I get that. I understand that. Because my life wasn't threatened. There's something, you know, my mind didn't go to fight or flight, you know. It wasn't a combat situation like a normal combat situation. So all of the, you know, medical jargon and all of the causes, I don't know about any of that. But what I do know is that there were a lot of stressed out youth.
Youth. Well, and for those youth, Heather wanted to get out of a small town in Pennsylvania, and then Daniel was homeless and said he had nowhere else to go, and so he enlisted. How common is this, where you're just getting a lot of lost young people becoming drone operators?
Well, I mean, I can't say, because I don't know what their lives were like. I mean, generally when you're in the military, what you see is a name tag and a uniform, and it kind of makes everyone in some way, many ways, the same. So sometimes you don't know about their history. But of the histories that I know about, there were people that basically wanted to find a job, wanted to be able to go through college, and thought it was a win-win. It's not that they didn't want to serve their country. I mean, they're patriotic. I mean, they basically sign up to do their tour of duty, you know, and, you know, their life is a blank check, right? But what happens on the other side of the wall, on the other side of the drone program, I mean, that is not something. I didn't know what was on the other side of that wall when I ended up there. I had no idea. And I've had a lot of experience in the military. But once you're inside that, it's like nothing else you've ever seen. And getting outside of that is not as easy as you might think, changing your job position and all of that, because it's shorthanded. And there's no end in sight to that shorthandedness, high op tempo.
Sonia, what would you add to that? What really struck you about the history of these young people? For example, Heather wanting to leave her small town, Daniel, who was homeless and had nowhere else to go, and then they become drone operators and experience just really deep PTSD. In fact, Heather's mom said that she has twice a week, for example, she's got episodes where she sees something, she hears something, and it's just consistent.
Well, I think Heather and Daniel's stories are very representative of who the military recruits. I know many veterans who, you know, come from small towns, who, you know, couldn't afford college by themselves, who, you know, who come from families who can't afford college for them. And so the military is an opportunity to get an education, to, as they say in their, ads and their recruiting offices, to travel the world. And the military really goes into these states like Pennsylvania and recruits very, very heavily out of these states and goes into high schools and tries to recruit the young people right out of high school. And I would, back up what Lisa said. I think, all three of the protagonists in my film, the U.S. protagonists, the whistleblowers, are very patriotic people. They all went into the military because they wanted to protect their country and protect people. And actually, I think the reason why they're speaking out now, why they became whistleblowers as well, is because they are patriotic, because they want to better the United States and the society and by speaking out, really just, do something good for their country. But I think, all of their stories are very representative for whom the military recruits.
Protop, what about the price some of these whistleblowers are paying? We briefly discussed this earlier, but when it comes to Daniel, a young man, on August 8th, 2014, during the production of the film National Bird, the FBI raided his home. They told him he was being charged with espionage, but they didn't tell him why. And with the permission of his lawyers, Sonia continued filming him. So can you talk about that? Since 1917, only 12 people have been prosecuted under the Espionage Act for allegedly mishandling classified information.
Well, there is a real threat to whistleblowers. I mean, as we've discussed, the PTSD, but then the fact that the government can come after them for anything they say in public by invoking national security and saying, well, you've broken the rules. There's actually a very poignant moment in the film where Heather's grandfather says that Heather couldn't actually go talk to a psychologist about her PTSD, because if the psychologist didn't have the right national security clearance, she would be violating the law by revealing to him what she did and why she was troubled. So imagine that if you cannot talk to your psychologist, psychiatrist, how is it going to be possible for these people to openly discuss the mistakes that they've seen? So for most people, this is a very scary proposition. What happened to Daniel is something that likely, Justin says this in the film, was intended to send a message. And I think it is something that people think about. They face the prospect. They see what happened to Edward Snowden. They see what happened to Chelsea Manning. So it is a way of making people keep quiet. Had the experiences, Brandon Bryant, who isn't in the film but has spoken out, where the FBI called them and said, hey, guess what? There's a terrorist group that is looking out to kill you, so you better keep quiet. So they have many different ways of getting people to try and get people to keep quiet. And therefore, I really applaud, Daniel, Heather, Lisa, Brandon, Sean, Stephen, and Michael, who've come forward despite this heavy pressure. But what makes it perhaps even hardest is that they have an automatic offer when they leave the military to go work for a private contractor. And I want to spend a second speaking about that, since I work for CorpWatch. A lot of this work is now being done by the private sector. And so there's another incentive, another way, disincentive for them to speak out. If they speak out, they're unlikely to get what could be $250,000 a year to go work in the private sector on the drone program, especially if they work in the overseas, in a place like Afghanistan, where they do what's called the launch and recovery element, LRE. They can be paid a lot of money. So there are a lot of disincentives for people to come and speak out. But at the same time, I think one of the reasons why they are speaking out is really the physical and mental impact of seeing people die in front of their eyes, knowing full well that nobody knew if they were innocent or guilty. And what the military is finding, in fact, is that they are having a really hard time keeping enough people in the program. The numbers speak for themselves. The Air Force actually came out at the beginning of last year to say that they were training 240 drone pilots a year, and they were losing 300 pilots a year. So it's simple math. The numbers of people that are leaving the program are greater than the people that are entering the program. So what they're doing now, as they're desperate, is turning to the private sector. And we have another problem here, because if you work for the private sector and then you speak out, you are not protected under federal whistleblower regulations. So if you go work for SAIC or Booz Allen Hamilton or Northrop Grumman, all these companies that work in the drone program, and you see something that's going wrong and you speak out, forget about losing your job, you can go to jail. And that, as I understand it, in fact, is one of the reasons why Daniel was also in trouble, was because, you know, if he's in the private sector, he is not subject to the kind of protection that an airman, somebody in the military has. So they are protected in some ways, even if the military does intimidate them.
Lisa, what has it been like for you to speak out?
So, well, one of the things I hope that this film accomplishes is that we're a democracy, which requires checks and balances. And the fact that the contractors are not able to speak out because they have zero whistleblower protections is criminal. It is absolutely criminal. And so, I mean, I would start with the premise, you know, that all governments are corrupt. Every government is corrupt. And there are other countries that have drones. I believe the last count was 54. I'm not 100% on that number, but I believe it was 54 other countries have drones. So before we can even address some sort of global standards, we need to address the fact that there are things within every government that does not make checks and balances even possible. And I wanted to also say that when I think about speaking out, I am very grateful to Sonia, who made it a point to hire legal help for both her film and to talk to Jesslyn Radak about us. And the program is part of Expose Facts, and it's the Whistleblower and Source Protection Program. And basically what's also happening to reporters and media such as yourself is, because of this fear of retaliation, what's happening is sources are drying up. And for poor, you know, for media folks, it's like a feeding frenzy. And in, like I say, in a democracy where we have the First and Fourth Amendments of our Constitution, that it doesn't equate to me.
Lisa Ling is a whistleblower and former drone system technical sergeant. And let's hear from David in Berkeley. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. And I'd like to thank the sergeant for her service to our country, and also thank you for expressing and sharing the humanist lessons in a real way. I know you're putting your neck out, even in private life, if you bring up the subject of death, especially death by expedient trial without a jury. People are almost on and off in their attitude about it, about their opinion of that, and take death very lightly. I'm wondering how much that has isolated you within the military. How many people actually have that opinion about the death penalty? I know, for instance, I'm voting for candidates Harris, because she doesn't believe in the death penalty. That she almost lost because their right-wingers were pointing that out.
Well, again,
and same with President Sanders. He doesn't believe in the death penalty, and I really believe we need to vote for people who are not so fast to go to war.
Thank you, David. He was talking about Kamala Harris, who's running for Senate in California.
Yeah, and I, you know, I totally understand that, but I want to put it, I want to bring the attention back that this is not Americans that we're talking about. These are people in Afghanistan, in Yemen, and in many other countries. And we need to stop with, you know, like putting people like me on a pedestal. I mean, there are families, children, mothers and fathers whose lives are in serious danger, who are threatened daily by drones flying over their head. And that's what I want to focus on.
Do we know how often drones are used today? I mean, Protop, how are you as a reporter getting this information?
Well, some of this is actually public information. There are 65 what are called combat air patrols, and the military publishes that. Just to explain what a combat air patrol is it is essentially a drone watch program over a particular location, and it involves 3 to 4 predators or reapers. So we're talking about anything between 200 and 250 drones in operation, taking off, hovering, returning, etc., and a lot of people involved. So the average combat air patrol is 186 people. So if you do the math on that, I forget the exact number, but it's something like 12,000 people are working round the clock, 24 hours a day, watching 65 different locations around the world. We believe they're mostly in places like Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, Afghanistan, now Syria. So the military believes it's a cheap way of following quote unquote terrorists or whatever. So we have some hard numbers into exactly what they're doing and where they're doing it. It's 65 locations. We also, of course, have reports from the ground because drones actually are not unseen. If there's a drone overhead, you'll hear it. In fact, this is one of the biggest problems. In addition to people getting killed by drone strikes, the drones make a noise, they kind of buzz, and that actually has a huge psychological impact on the people on the ground. So if you think...
And Protop, we have just 1 minute left. I'm sorry to cut you off, but I wanted to mention quickly that 1,000 people attended the Berlin Film Festival for a discussion about National Bird. And Lisa and Sonia, you're going to be at all of the screenings for the San Francisco Film Festival over the coming week. Lisa, quickly, what do you hope comes from this film and the information that it provides and reveals?
Well, I hope that a discussion comes out of it where Americans are more aware of what's happening overseas in their name. I mean, we're looking at war, and all we're doing is seeing it on television and seeing it in some distant way, which lends to forgetting these are people we're talking about.
And what about you, Sonia?
Well, I think it's one of these times where, you know, technology has really outpaced moral frameworks and, you know, legal frameworks. And I think our society and our, you know, government really have to catch up and internationally even develop a legal framework. And I hope this film would start this discussion.
Sonia Kennebec's new film is National Bird. It'll be screened at the San Francisco International Film Fest. Check yourcallradio.org for screening times. Protop Chatterjee is managing editor of CorpWatch. Lisa Ling is a whistleblower and former drone system technical sergeant. Lisa Ling and Sonia Kennebec will be at all of the screenings. It'll be in theaters nationwide in the fall. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll discuss the City College of San Francisco's faculty strike. After a year of failed negotiations, the union that represents CCSF faculty has called for a one-day strike on Wednesday. It's the first faculty strike in the union's three-decade history. Union President Tim Kelly says, "We are striking for the City College San Francisco deserves." So what are the issues at stake and how can they be resolved? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.